Brown?
From the Brown Bag.
From the Brown Bag Group. Yeah. Please join me now in welcoming Kirk W.
Small room. I don't feel like I got to stand way back there, do I?
Yeah.
All
right.
All right. All right.
Where's the microphone?
No microphone, no small room. We're good. You can take your stance where you feel comfortable.
Good deal. All right, buddy. My name is Kirk, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kirk.
All right. I've been sober for 16 years. My sobriety date is June 12, 2006. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. Tonight I'm going to tell you what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. You know, originally I'm from this small town called Georgetown, South Carolina. And give you an idea how small it is, Suffolk has three high schools, Georgetown has one. Yeah. So smaller, it's actually smaller than Suffolk. So basically, everybody knew everybody. I came from, you know, both of my parents were educated. I came from a middle class family. And on the outside, we seemed like the average family. However, my dad is an alcoholic. And, as you know, living with an alcoholic can be stressful, embarrassing, and downright miserable. So I told myself that I was never gonna grow up to be like my father. I was not gonna be an alcoholic, okay? Well, let's fast forward to my first drink. You know, I grew up this shy, nerdy kid. Didn't really feel like I quite fit in with anybody. And I was at a house party one night, and they had alcohol at this house party. And I took a drink. And it was like, for the first time in my life, I felt comfortable in my skin. I felt the fears and anxieties went away. That night, I could dance. I could talk to women, and I heard something that night that all of us alcoholics love to hear. Somebody that night said, "Kirk, I like you this way. It's on." And it seems like, you know, I was this broken individual, and the alcohol seemed to fix what was wrong with me. Amazingly, I got into a clique where I'm drinking with other people, and they're calling me and letting me know about other house parties. And I'm going to these house parties, and we're drinking. There's women drinking there too. And you know, when women drink and guys drink, let down your inhibitions. So now I'm sexually active as a teenager. See, this is a lifestyle I've been looking for as a teenager. And now, I did have my first son at age 18, so some repercussions from that, but I didn't screw him up too bad. and being in a small town, as far as, you know, I was about 16 when I started drinking, and I know, listen to some other people share, I'm a late bloomer, but I was about 16, so I'm underage as far as drinking goes, but being underage in a small town never stopped me from drinking at all. Hey, come on in.
Sorry.
Hey everyone, this is Nyman. Like I said, being in the small town never stopped me. I knew the people that owned the bars, they knew me, they knew my family, so I could go in and order a drink in a bar when I was 16 years old. And you remember I mentioned that my father was an alcoholic. So my father, you know, I was basically raised in the bootlegger house. My father would go to the bootlegger, And the bootlegger would give me some magic markers and some paper and sit me in the corner. And they would always give me this little, they used to sell these little orange juice, the little bluebird orange juice. And they give me that, I'm good. I can entertain myself for hours in the bootlegger house if I could color and drink orange juice. So when I got my license, at age 15, my dad would send me to the bootlegger house to get alcohol. And once I started drinking, well, I know where to go. I just go to the bootlegger house and say it's for my dad, and you know, we're off. But I still couldn't drink like I wanted to drink, because I was living with my parents, and I was drinking on the weekends. We call it a weekend warrior. And then I finally graduated from high school and I went off to college. College is where my drinking career took off. Believe it or not, it's where it took off. When I first got to college, the first day, my parents helped me unload my stuff in boxes into my dorm room. And as soon as they left, I didn't even unpack, because down the hall they were having a keg party. So I walked down the hall and say, hey, y'all having a keg party? And it was like, yeah, man, grab a cup. I'm like, cool. I got some new friends here. You know? So we start, you know, we're drinking and they was like, well, Kirk, we're going downtown to the new bar. You want to come? Hell yeah. You see, that alcohol was a way for me, it was like a lubricant as far as me associating it with other people. It allowed me to get out of my skin, get rid of those fears and anxieties, and interact. And now I'm in college, and not only that, these guys show me that alcohol can actually taste good. They introduced me to drinks like Fuzzy Navels, Kamikazes, Lemon Drops, and we even take shots of birthday cake. They actually had a shot that tastes like birthday cake. This is really what I wanted, you know? And I did get in trouble a little bit in college behind my drinking, but I was able to seem like get out of it. I remember I was coming from this party, and this cop was in the corner, and I was going back to campus, and I dang near blew his doors off when I drove by. And here comes the blue lights. And he pulls me over. And he asked me for my driver's license and registration. And he said, how old are you? I said, 19. And he said, how many drinks have you had tonight? You know what I told him.
Two.
It's always two. I don't care if you had 22 drinks. It's always two when the officer asks you how much you had to drink tonight. Yeah. So, you know, he asked me to step out of the car, and the blue lights are going on everything. Now, again, I'm in college, and I'm taking chemistry, biology, physics. He asked me to say my ABCs. Don't you know? I could not say my ABCs. Couldn't say it. So, you know, this officer, man, he sat there and talked to me for a long time. Gave me a lecture about how his roommate in college got a DUI. And after he graduated, he was unable to get a government job. This guy, he just took a lot of time and talked to me. So after we're done talking, blue lights, my buzz is gone now. Okay, it's completely gone. He asked me to say my ABCs, and I said them, but no problem. And then he told me to go home, and he told me, son, he said, if you're gonna drink and drive, don't speed. That's what I took from my 30-minute lecture. I didn't stop drinking and driving, but I stopped speeding. Okay, I slowed my butt down, and I took my time getting to A to B when I was drinking and driving. And the funny thing about that, too, is that since I've graduated from college. All I've ever had was a government job. I didn't realize how much of a help that officer gave me by not giving me a DUI that night. Or maybe it would have prevented me from continuing drinking. Who knows? But my drinking career, it continued. And again, there was a lot of what you call it, DUI checkpoints and stuff. I actually was able to get by through those. And then finally, I got married and had a son with my wife, and that's when more responsibility came into the picture. And you know, responsibility and drinking don't mix. So now my drinking is causing me problems in my relationship. During the time I was married, I developed MS. That's multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. And everyone I knew that had MS was either in a wheelchair or they died. And that's how I picture more of my alcoholic thinking. That's how I picture my future. And before that, I was trying to control my drinking. Now the gloves are off. I started drinking more. I started isolating myself from the family. I even built a ramp on the back, what you call it, on the back door, so I can just roll myself in, you know, in a wheelchair and sit in the backyard underneath the tree all day. Basically, that's how I picture my future. So I started drinking like today was my last day to drink. And of course, this is causing issues with my marriage, of course. And on top of that, I got a DUI while I was working in Florida. So now it's like it's become public about my problem. As far as my drinking goes. And with the DUI, they asked me to take the breathalyzer and I refused it. And when you refuse the breathalyzer in Florida, that's an automatic DUI and a year suspension. And on top of that, I had to go to counseling. And I went to counseling, and you know what my counselors told me? He wanted me to go to AA. And I'm like, AA, that's for alcoholics. Why are you sending me to AA? I knew I wasn't an alcoholic because my father was an alcoholic. I know what that looks like. I've seen that all my life. My father would wake up with the shakes and had to take a drink to stop shaking. He would go on days on binges, drinking binges. I didn't drink every day. I never woke up with the shakes. So the little box in my head of what I created, of what an alcoholic was, I didn't fit in that box. I'm not an alcoholic. And I played the tape about the DUI in my mind about what happened there. That night I got the DUI. All right, remember, after work I went to the bar, I started drinking, I blacked out, I wrecked my car. That's how I got the DUI. And I remember that I didn't eat anything before I drank. That's why I blacked out, that's why I wrecked the car and got the DUI. If I had only eaten something. So I looked at AA as punishment for not eating before I So I showed up here to get my paper signed, knowing I don't belong here. And as people shared and went around the room, they told my story one by one. But I was fairly young at the time, and I heard a whole lot of not yets and not yets are things that just haven't happened to you yet. So, I even said to myself, well, if it gets that bad, I'll come back. I got my paper signed, and I got my license back, but this time I had a plan. I had a plan this time. This time I'm gonna eat before I drink. This is gonna solve my drinking problem. Well, I stayed home and drank, and by doing that, created more problems in my marriage by now staying home and drinking. And I swear, man, I used to look at my ex-wife as a wet blanket. There were some days where I hadn't even had a drink yet. I'll grab a beer out of the fridge and sit down on the couch and pop that can and go, and she would hear it and go, I can't believe you're drinking already. I was like, my gosh, I ain't taken a sip yet. What a nag. You know, and it took AA for me to see that my ex-wife was not a nag. She was not a wet blanket. She just wanted me to be a responsible husband, a responsible father, a responsible person. And I wasn't that when I was drinking. But I continued to drink. By this time, my ex-wife had asked me for a divorce. My job told me that they were moving me to Norfolk, and I was having issues with my job because of my legal problems with the DUI. I was having some health issues. It was like it was coming from everywhere, and by this time, you know, I'm still living with my ex-wife. And I'm hiding alcohol around the house. By this time that I'm hiding alcohol around the house, just because I don't want to hear her. I knew I had a drinking problem at this point. I knew normal people don't hide alcohol. But there was one day I had found a can of Smith's Malt Liquor. It was a 24-ounce can that I had hid in my closet, and basically I hid it for myself. I didn't know it was there. And so I grabbed that can. It was a Slip's Malt Liquor bowl. So I grabbed that can of Slip's Malt Liquor, closed the closet door, got in it, and popped that lid. You know, I don't know if any of you guys ever had hot Slip's Malt Liquor. But it tasted like piss going down, man. And I'm like, here I am in this dark closet drinking hot Slip's Malt Liquor bowl. There has to be a better life, a better way to live than this right here. And that night, you know, I said the shortest prayer I ever said, which was probably the best prayer I ever said. I said, God help me. And a light bulb came on and said, Kirk, won't you try AA? I've been to AA before, but I never tried it. So, I didn't know it at that moment, but that was my last drink I ever took. I went to AA. And I did something the second time I did not do the first time. The second time I stuck my hand out and asked for help. And there were people in these rooms willing to help me. I didn't know anything about AA. Zero, just this place you go for people who had drinking problems. So I wiped knuckle it. What I did do though, in the beginning, I would pray to God to help me get through the day without taking a drink, and I would go to a meeting. When I did both of those things, not just pray, but also go to a meeting, I would come home, I would go to this 5:30 meeting after work, and that was a happy hour drink. So it took the place of my drinking, the meeting did. And something miraculously what happened is that I didn't drink. After I would pray to God, go to a meeting, I didn't drink. And I managed to get 30 days. And when I got 30 days, this lady in AA, she gave me the big book, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard about this big book, but never seen it. Never saw the big book, Alcoholics book in my life, never saw it. And it was because I went to the same meeting at the same time, location. It was a 5:30 meeting. It was always open discussion. And on Saturdays, it was a speaker meeting. So I never saw the big book. I took that book home. I started reading it. And it taught me a lot about alcoholism. It taught me a lot about the AA program. And I can honestly say, if that lady did not give me that book, I probably would not be standing here before you today. And what she did was probably, I'm sure she don't even remember doing that simple gesture. But I actually wanted to thank her. And I knew her name, couldn't find out, you know, Google her name on the internet, and the mug shots popped up. She was arrested for possession of crack cocaine, next year distribution of crack cocaine. You see, she was a sick person. But she was able to help me. That just shows you that God is able to use sick people to help other sick people get well. So I do appreciate it. I hope one day I get a chance to let her know what a big part she was in my recovery. But after that, you know, I managed to get 3 months before my job moved me here to Norfolk. So that's how I ended up here in Norfolk. When I got to Norfolk, my job, they put me in the Doubletree Hotel on Military Highway. Remember, there was a hotel that was attached to the military mall. That's where I stayed. I didn't know anybody here. I felt pretty bad because my, you know, divorce is going through the process, and I didn't even know, oh, my job, by the way, I didn't even know I was going to be able to even keep the job that relocated me here. Because when I got here, it opened up a new case for me to have to pass my security clearance. I already passed it before I got the DUI, but now I moved to a new location. And I wasn't sure if this DUI thing was going to allow me to do that. So I had all of this over my head. So I went to the Easy Does It Club. It wasn't that far away from my hotel. I didn't know a lot of people. And you guys ever been to the Easy Does It Club? They got a lot of old timers and they got a lot of newcomers. Well, I didn't think the old timers knew my pain. I didn't think they knew what I was going through. So I hung out with the newcomers. And at first it was great. You know, after the meeting, me and the newcomers, we would go and out to eat, or we would go and shoot pool. We basically hung out together. And then after a few months, my newcomer friends stopped coming to meetings, stopped answering my phone calls. But guess what? They left me with the old timers. So I had to walk over there and start talking to the old timers. And the old timers, they got me involved with service work. And I started, you know, cleaning up the place, started making coffee. They even trust me enough to start open up the meetings. And one day, I'd open up the meeting, make coffee, and I was there by myself. There's usually tons of people at the Easy Does It Club, but nobody was there that day. So that day, I was brewing the coffee, sitting outside of the Easy Does It Club, and this truck pulls up in the parking lot. And the guy gets out of the truck yelling at the woman on the passenger side, like, "Get your ass out the truck! Get out!" And he goes over to the passenger side and snatches the woman out of the truck and slams the door and peels off out of the parking lot. And I'm like, man, what a jerk. And this woman, she's standing in the parking lot bawling. She's crying. It's just me and her. I don't know what to say to somebody when they're crying. You know, I walked up to her and I was like, "Hey, I made some coffee. Come on inside." So we went inside and I poured a cup of coffee and I poured myself a cup of coffee and I told her who I was and she told me who she was and we get to talking. So finally, you know, I get to that, like, "What was that about in the parking lot there?" And she said, "That's my husband." And she said, "Last week I lost my job because of my drinking." And she said, "Last night I got a DUI and my husband just bailed me out of jail. And he's making me go to this meeting." And I thought, oh, her husband's not a jerk. Just don't know what to do with your crazy ass. But I got a chance to see that woman stay in AA and see her grow and become a happy person. She looked nothing like that person I saw that day crying in the parking lot. I got a chance to just see how this program changes lives. And it was all because I was doing service work. You know, that day, I thought I was just going there to make some coffee. But I'm glad I was there to at least welcome the newcomer and invite her in and make her feel comfortable in the rooms at AA. You know, that's what this program has done for me. Now, I managed to stay in these rooms for a long time without fully embracing the AA program. I read the steps, didn't see what it had to do with drinking or not drinking. I thought it was for people that were really bad. Alcoholism really bad. So I didn't work the steps for about 5 years. I'm kind of just hanging around AA. And then after 5 years, I was so miserable here in AA. I was so sad and depressed. And I heard someone said, if you're in AA and you're not happy, it's because you're not working the program right. And you know, I wasn't working the program at all. I was working Kirk's AA program, but I wasn't working AA program. So I decided to get a sponsor as what was suggested and work the steps. So now I get the sponsor and I'm ready to work the steps. I was like, let's go. And my sponsor was like, well, hold on, Kirk. Before we work the steps, tell me something about yourself. I was like, well, I'm an alcoholic. What you want to know? He was like, well, are you seeing somebody? And I was like, yeah, I'm seeing a married woman right now. He was like, well, we're going to have to fix that. And then he's like, Kirk, so what do you do when you're not going to the meetings and messing with the married woman? What do you do in your spare time? I told him, well, I like to go to the poker house in Chesapeake. And at this time, gambling was illegal. I said, poker house? Well, Kirk, tell me about the poker house. I said, well, you go up to the poker house, you knock on the door, and a big old dude with a gun answers the door. And you go inside and sit and play cards. He was like, well, what type of people are at the poker house? I said, I don't know, drug dealers, pimps, you know, people with money. You know, after I talked to my sponsor, I realized that all I did was stop drinking and my behavior did not change. I was still acting like I was drinking. And I heard the saying, once a drunken horse thief stops drinking, all you got is a horse thief that doesn't drink anymore. And that was me. I'm still a horse now. Just ain't drinking. So me and my sponsor decided to work the steps. Step one is the only step I've ever done perfect so far. I have not taken a drink. And I knew my life was unmanageable just by, it wasn't hard to do. Step two is believe in a power that's higher than yourself. Always believe in God. My mom made me go to church when I was living with her. Went to church on a regular basis. I was an usher and all that good stuff. But when I left my parents' home, went to church every now and then. You know, I grew up a Baptist, but after I moved out from my parents' house, I became a CME. You guys know what a CME is? A CME are people who go to church on Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter. All right? I went to church every now and then, but you ain't gonna catch me in there that often. So, no problem with believing that there was a higher power. Also, we got to step three. Now, I had a little issue with step three, when you have to turn your will over to the care of God as you understood Him. And I talked to my sponsors like, man, if I turn my will over to God, I don't want to be one of those guys in Virginia Beach in front of the bar with a Bible yelling, y'all going to hell if y'all don't change y'all. I didn't want to be that dude. And he was like, Kirk is not like that. You know? When you turn your will over to the care of God, you're basically telling God you're going to do this way. And I went ahead and did that. And, you know, doing step three, something amazing happened. You know, one of the things I did, I would say this, the third step prayer in the morning, every morning, which is about turning my will over to God and being in the service of other people. And something miraculously happened. I actually started going back to church again. I joined church. I got involved with the men's ministry. And life started getting good. The bad things that I was doing, I stopped doing. Got rid of the married woman. I did have a problem with that. You know, it's amazing what you tell yourself when you're doing certain things, bad things, versus talking to a sponsor out loud. I told myself I wasn't doing nothing wrong because I'm single. All right? Mm-hmm. She's coming to my house. I'm not married. But once you say that out loud to a sponsor, it doesn't fly. Okay? It doesn't fly. And by getting a sponsor during step three, I stopped going to the poker house. It's just a whole lot of bad habits, bad things that I was doing, I stopped doing, and life got better. I had no idea. When you start doing good things start happening to you. Who knew? Never tried it before. And then we got to step four. Now, step four is when you do a moral inventory. Man, I put that step four off for a long time. I tried my best to just keep putting that off. And finally, my sponsor said, we're doing step five on Friday. I told him I wasn't ready. He said, no, we're doing step five on Friday. So I went ahead and I did step five. And you know, I had no idea. Step five was the first time I had a spiritual experience, I guess, in this program. I had no idea how much weight I was carrying and as far as all this guilt and shame. By sharing the stuff that I've done and the things I went through, a big old weight was lifted off my shoulder. I didn't realize how much guilt and shame I was carrying. So step five was wonderful. Didn't have any issues with step six or seven, where you ask God to remove your shortcomings and your bad characters. I had no problems with that. Step eight, so that's when you make a list of the people you have harmed and willing to make amends to them. Well, there was one guy on there on my step eight I didn't want to put him on my list. But I messed up. I already mentioned him in my fourth step. So my sponsor knew about him. Messed up. And he was telling me, Kirk, if you don't go back and correct the wreckage of your past, you will drink again. And I'm like, I'm already gonna let it. No, this guy can get hit by a truck. I am not gonna drink over him. I'm good without ever making amends to him, all right? But he insisted. So when I got to step nine, and basically, I guess I was willing to go to England to get sober because I didn't see how this amends was gonna make a difference. But I went to that guy, and I said some bad things to him. He said some bad things to me. But when I went to him that day, I did not bring up the stuff that he did or said. I only brought up the stuff that I did. I brought it up, I told him, and I apologized to him for the stuff that I've done. And I asked him, what can I do to make up for it? After we did the amends, you know, we were cool and everything, but there was no hugging, no like, oh, I miss you, man. None of that went down. But a couple weeks later, he called me up. He had a problem with his son, and we both had sons the same age. He was just saying, hey, Kirk, I got this issue. Tell me what you would do and all that. And before you know it, I'm calling him, and we're friends again, you know? Had no idea that would work, despite what I thought about it. And that just shows you this program works despite what you think. Just do the steps, guys. Just do. You don't have to try to figure out how it works or will it work. Just do it. And for me, it worked. And step 10. Step 10, we went through step 10 is basically letting us know that once we do 1 through 9, we're not going to be perfect. We're going to offend people, and it tells us whenever we do anything wrong, promptly admit it and try to correct it. So step 10, you know, it was a growing thing. There was a time, one time it happened, I was talking to this lady named Mary. And she knows I'm in AA, and I mentioned a friend of ours that we know, his name is Tony. I said, well, I was talking to Tony the other day after our AA meeting. She said, Tony's in AA? And I was like, oh, snap. I just broke Tony's anonymity. So I had to go and talk to Tony and tell Tony what I did. And I said, Tony, hey, I was talking to Mary the other day, and I told her that we were in a meeting, and I didn't know, she didn't know you were an AA, man. I apologize for that. He was like, Kirk, that's fine. People at work, my anonymity is not a big secret. People at work knows I'm an AA, and when someone has a drinking problem at work, they bring the guy to me. It's no issue. See, the old me would have been like, hey, Mary, let's not tell Tony about this. Let's keep this between ourselves. And then I would have been worrying about Tony finding out that I broke his anonymity. That's what this program has done for me. It's given me the ability to admit I was wrong and go up to people and make those errors. I don't have to have just stuff hanging over my head and lying about those things that really don't need to be lied about. You know? It's just giving me a roadmap to this way of life. And step 11 is we talk about doing prayer and meditation to get our closest contact with God. Well, I had to come to AA to learn how to pray. Before I got to AA, I did not know how to pray. That third step prayer, it starts off with, God, please allow me to do your will today. I never thought about doing God's will before I came to AA. When I would pray, I would ask God, please give me this, please give me that. I kind of had God and Santa Claus confused. You know, it was like, give me, give me, give me. And so I had to learn that it ain't about me. It's about others. It's about me being a service to other people and doing what God wants me to do. Do I know what God's will is for me? No. I do know what's not God's will for me. I know lying, stealing, and cheating is not God's will. So I don't do those things. And if the opportunity presents itself, I will do my best to help others. Meditation is hit and miss, I'll be honest. Sometimes I meditate. Most times I just wake up and hit the ground running. Or when I'm all wound up and stressed out, now I want to meditate. I want to unwind. I want to feel the relief. So I will go ahead and light my candles, put on the music, and go like, all right, damn it, I'm going to be able to relax and meditate. Now let's go. Meditation should be proactive, not reactive. And I'm a growing process. I'm learning that. So like, I haven't done it perfect yet. And step 12 is just basically us carrying the message, working with other people. The best part about this program, every time I'm working with a newcomer and I take the newcomer through the steps, I go through the steps too. It keeps it fresh in my mind. This disease wants to kill us, and it will try to suppress the bad memories and just probably bring up the good memories. Like that time I sat at the bar and that pretty girl sat beside me and said, hey, let me buy you a drink. I remember that like it's yesterday, man. I don't remember the day I was at the party and I peed on myself and everybody saw me. Those memories I try to suppress, all right? Alcohol don't bring those memories up to you. So by doing the 12 step, working with others, it keeps it fresh for me. Prior to COVID, I've been going to the jails for about 10 years. I'm going to get back into doing that. I thought I was going to the jails to help those guys bring the message. Man, they actually helped me. I didn't realize my bottom could have been a lot worse than like drinking away my family. They went and got other families and drunk. They drunk two or three families away. I didn't realize I could do that. You know, I just stopped at that one. Mm-hmm. So they have actually helped me, and I've hoped that I've actually helped some of them. I've actually seen a few of them, not many, but I've seen a few come out of the jails and start going to meetings. So if I just save one out of 100, it's worth it. It's worth me going into those jails. But, you know, this program is amazing if you just work it. And I'm going to basically finish talking with this. You know, even after all of these times, I had trouble when I first got here convincing myself that I was an alcoholic. I finally had an aha moment in AA when I realized why I'm an alcoholic. I got up with one of my old drinking buddies, Doug, one time during the Christmas holidays. And this is after I've been in the program for years, for a few years anyway. And I took Doug out, and I got a chance to watch Doug drink. Doug had, and you know what? Even though he's my drinking buddy, he's not an alcoholic. He's not like, he's not one of us. He does not have the consequences that comes for drinking that we do. Just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to him. But so I got a chance to watch Doug drink, and I watched him. He took one drink, he took another drink, and he got a third drink. And when he got halfway down, he put that drink on the table and pushed it away. You know why Doug pushed the drink away? Because he felt like he was losing control. See, I'm an alcoholic. I take two drinks. I'm gaining control, man. I feel stronger. I can dance now. I can talk to women. You know, I am more powerful once I've had a couple of drinks. I'm not losing control. I'm gaining. And that was the aha moment. That's the difference between me and a normal drinker, because it's not how much you drink, and it's not how often you drink. It's what happens to you when you start drinking. And once I start drinking, I can't quit. I'm off to the races. You know, they say first you take the drink and then the drink takes you, and that's me. I have no control over when I'm going to stop drinking once I start. So today I know I'm an alcoholic without a shadow of a doubt, and I know why today too. Can't take that first drink. So if you new in here, no one in AA can tell you that you're an alcoholic. But if alcohol is causing you problems, then maybe you have a problem with alcohol. Thanks for letting me share.
So this is usually where my sponsor or someone else with a lot more experience than I would step up and say something.